This Sandwell News podcast is divided into chapters.
The Sandwell News for Saturday, September the 5th. Sunrise this coming week will be at 6:30. Sunset at 7:40 p.m. By Tuesday, temperatures will reach 21 degrees. It will be a bit windy, but rather less rain than of late.
Welcome to the first autumnal edition of the Sandwell News for the blind and visually impaired community in and around Sandwell. Yes, we're out of summer and into official meteorological autumn. The reminder that if you're online or get the podcast, you'll get the talking news a bit before the 5th of September, maybe the 3rd or 4th. Coming up next, what's going on at SVI, and this is a bit different to our usual roundup. I don't have the usual summary of events for next week, but here first are some of the highlights that I can give you without having that. Two special events coming up next week, and after that there'll be just a reminder of the regular things that SVI puts on each week.
Hi, Sophie here from Wonder in Nature. Going to tell you about the next Nature Connection Through the Senses session, which is going to be on Monday the 7th of September, 1:30 p.m. till 4 p.m. at Oak House, West Bromwich. You can meet at Sandwell Visually Impaired offices and walk down, or meet at the gate at Oak House. We're going to be working through the sense of sound and spending time in the far corner of the gardens, which is a walled garden. We'll be listening to the birds and other nature sounds, and going to have a mini sound bath which you'll be able to interact with. So I hope that you will join us. Please register your interest with Sandwell Visually Impaired. I look forward to seeing you soon. Bye.
Women's group Coventry Jaunt on Wednesday the 9th of September. Women of SVI, join us as we travel on the train to Coventry. Meeting at Sandwell and Dudley train station at 10 a.m, we will visit the old and new cathedrals, where we will learn of their history and the devastating damage done during the wartime blitz. Afterwards we will browse the shops, stopping for lunch before our train journey home. The trip is free, but please remember to bring your travel passes for the train. Let the office know you're coming so that we can meet you at the station and help us to know how many sighted guides are needed.
A brief rundown of SVI activities this week. Gym at Portway Lifestyle Centre. Join us for a gym workout every Tuesday morning from 10 a.m. to 12 noon at Portway Lifestyle Centre. Showdown at Portway Lifestyle Centre. Every Tuesday afternoon at 2 p.m. and Thursday morning, 10 a.m. to 12 noon at Portway Lifestyle Centre. Dartmouth Park Walk. Walks take place every Thursday from 12 noon to 2:30 p.m. Meet us by the Dartmouth Park War Memorial, from where we will take a leisurely walk around the park and Sandwell Valley, stopping off for refreshments. Please tell us you are coming so we can make sure we have enough sighted guides.
A selection of headlines from our newspaper readings this week, courtesy of Express and Star Publications. In Wednesday's news, millions pledged for affordable and council homes. Blood donors urged to come forward. Thursday, exhibition reveals human cost of war. Visit to spring that gave Sandwell its name. Friday, woman left partially blind after medics failed to spot condition. Burnham announces crackdown to put cowboy builders out of business. Saturday, hospices get £5 million deal to help NHS. Barewood Dental Surgery Extension Plan appealed. Monday, drivers warned of bus lane fines, speeches in canal murder trial. On this day, August 31st. Tuesday, future storm names announced. Flu vaccine rolled out. Smethwick 9-bed HMO is appealed. Division over social care tax proposals.
Of course, amongst all those stories are one or two about West Bromwich Albion, and we've not one but two reports. I've just managed to get a report of the latest Albion versus Charlton match, which happened last night as I speak, and Linda will be along too with a report of the Albion-Middlesbrough match, which wasn't such good news for Albion supporters. Of course, as usual, we'll have the TV and radio listings for the week ahead from Talking News Federation, and most likely another piece from them in the second part of the paper. But for now, we hear this week's news, starting, as always, with Wednesday's news.
This is James Brodie bringing to you stories from the Express and Star, dated the 26th of August. Region getting £409 million for 3,200 affordable homes. Largest council house building programme since the post-war era is promised, and this story is brought to you by Mark Andrews. The West Midlands is to get an extra £409 million to provide 3,200 new homes for people in temporary accommodation or housing waiting lists. Richard Parker, the region's elected mayor, said that the money would be on top of the funds he had made available for his target to build 2,000 social rental homes a year by 2028. The money is part of a near £10 billion commitment by the Prime Minister, who said that he wanted to embark on the largest council house building programme since the post-war era to tackle the severe housing shortages and homelessness. Mr Parker said that the money, which is a result of a partnership with the government and Homes England, would be used alongside his own housing funds to build thousands more homes that were genuinely affordable for local people. He said since taking office in May 2024, he had overseen the biggest social housing programme in the West Midlands that had been experienced in decades, setting a target for the region to be building 2,000 social rent homes a year by 2028. Mr Parker said he contracted a record 7,237 new homes over the past year, more than 10 times the annual 623 average achieved before he took office. Of the new homes, he said that 2,452 were affordable, including 1,086 for social rent, the most affordable type of housing. Mr Parker said for decades there's been a chronic underinvestment in council homes and genuinely affordable housing. It's left us with the housing crisis we face today. I believe people deserve better, which is why we focus on fixing the mistakes of the past and rebuilding our housing stock. He said nearly 15,000 children in the region were living in temporary accommodation, adding, "I want that number coming down, and I want it to be coming down quickly." NHS Trust team shortlisted for National Patient Safety Award. This story is brought to you by Subtan Mahood. Supporting this article are two pictures. The first picture has the caption, "The Martha's Rule Implementation Team at Sandwell and West Birmingham NHS Trust, which has been shortlisted for a national award." The second picture has the caption, "Leo Davis leads for Martin's Rule with Jenny Coldwalder Hunt. Both of them are wearing blue NHS outfits." Sandwell and West Birmingham NHS Trust has been shortlisted for a national award for its work giving patients and families a stronger voice in their care. The Trust has been named as a finalist in the Nursing-led Patient Safety Initiative of the Year category at next month's HSJ Patient Safety Awards of 2026. The recognition is for the introduction of the Patient Wellness Questionnaire, that's the PWQ, as part of Martha's Rule, a national patient safety initiative designed to ensure patients, families, carers can raise concerns if they feel that a patient's condition is deteriorating. Martha's Rule give patients and families the ability to seek an urgent review if they're worried about a patient's condition and feel that their concerns are not being adequately addressed. The Patient Wellness Questionnaire is used during patients' interactions to ask whether people feel better, worse or the same, and whether they've noticed any changes in their condition. Responses are considered alongside clinical observations, helping staff to build a further picture of a patient's health. Where concerns are raised, they can be escalated for further review and intervention. The Trust said that patients and families can sometimes spot subtle changes in a person's condition before they are reflected in routine monitoring. Lee Davies, head of Martha's Rule and the Deteriorating Patient Programme Delivery, said, "The shortlisting recognises the work of colleagues across the Trust." He said that being shortlisted for a National HSJ Patient Safety Award is testament to the hard work, commitment and passion shown by the team. Martha's Rule is about ensuring patients and families are heard, empowered and supported when they have concerns about a loved one's condition. Group Chief Executive Diane Wake said that she was incredibly proud to see the work recognised nationally. She said that Martha's Rule is fundamentally about listening to patients and families, taking their concerns seriously and ensuring that they have a clear way to ask for further help when they feel something is not right. This shortlisting has thoroughly deserved recognition for Leo and everyone involved in embedding this work across the Trust, and I would like to congratulate the whole team on this achievement. The HSJ Patient Safety Awards recognise the NHS organisations. This also includes teams making a difference to patient safety and experience with awards celebrating innovation, leadership and best of practice. It's an urban jungle hunt on the wildest streets weeds. Our streets are lined with all kinds of plant life, as our unscientific survey reveals. This story is brought to you by Mark Andrews. Supporting this article is a man standing next to some weeds with the caption, "Examining the butterfly bush outside QuickFit in Wolverhampton city centre. It's something to behold, thriving as weed control no longer happens." The next picture is exploring the weeds at Wolverhampton Road East in Goldthorne Park. The final image has the caption, "What a lovely Taraxacum officinale," and that is a picture of a man standing next to some dandelions. Welcome to Weed Watch, wildlife safari with a difference, and it's right up your street. Instead of spending hours in the middle of nowhere peering through binoculars, the Express and Star's own nature safari takes you around the heart of the West Midlands, exploring the exotic plant life growing at the sides of our roads, in our gutters and across the pavements. You would have to be living under a stone or at least deep in the undergrowth of a grass verge not to have noticed the masses of wildlife taking root around the region at the moment. A combination of reduced maintenance, council budgets, a long hot summer, not to mention the temperature being too warm to use weed killer, have led to many of our urban landscapes being turned into mini jungles. But what is actually out there? Following on from the success of last year's pothole safari, we hit the road armed only with a notepad and a library book on wildflowers, and it didn't take us long to find some interesting floras. About 100 yards from our office in the centre of Wolverhampton, we came across a magnificent butterfly bush sprouting out of the pavements in Lever Street up the side of QuickFit. Comfortably towering over my 6-foot frame, this rampant specimen known in the horticultural circles as the buddleia has a very powerful stem structure and pointed purple flowers. It's a pain if you actually wanted to walk along the pavement, which was all but overwhelmed by it. But if you want a photograph of wild shrubbery, then it's unlikely setting, it's just the job. Just around the corner, in Rabby Street, there is a particularly strong example of a Taraxacum officinale poking out on the pavement, its bright yellow florets lapping up at the summer sunshine. More commonly known as the common dandelion, these upright perennial flowers from March through to October, and its leaves can be eaten in salads, its flowers made into wine, and its roots roasted as coffee substitute. Yum yum. Heading out of the city, we spot an interesting combination of wildlife surrounding a felled tree stump at the side of Wolverhampton Road East. First up is the southern global thistle, a compact bushy weed growing to 24 inches tall with broad prickly leaves and bearing globes of steel blue flowers, commonly found in southern and eastern Europe. It thrives in warm climates. A bit more of a surprise is what is growing next to it, a common sunflower. Not a huge one, admittedly, but not the type of thing you expect to be growing on the verge of the side of a busy main road. Over in Lomond Road, Sedgley, the forces of nature appear to have got the better of the council workmen, who have made a somewhat half-hearted attempt to tidy the area up. The grass has been cut, but rather untidily, with the edges left long, and nature has made a land grab for the pavement, which is now overrun with grass. On the corner of the street, opposite Lee Rise, is a row of Epilobium hystercium, or hairy willow herbs, a tall perennial. It can reach a height of up to 7 foot, although there are probably just under half of that at the moment. Its robust stems are profusely furry and soft-spreading hairs with long, thin, hairy leaves and large purple-pink flowers. It is poisonous to cats and dogs, so be careful that they don't eat it. In Ettymore Road, Sedgley, we discover another butterfly bush, which is probably the find of the day, at least 10 foot tall. It was perhaps more wild tree than weed, as its strong spiky leaves and bright purple flowers have attracted the interest of local bees. But if it's diversity of species you're looking for, then head over to the junction of Birmingham New Road and Sedgley Road in Tipton, which appears to have developed an ecosystem all of its own. Copse bindweed, also known as thicket bindweed, is rampant on what was once an orderly landscaped area, along with elm leaf blackberries and the horticultural's favourites, the Urtica dioica, otherwise known as stinging nettles. But my favourite is the coral berry, or to be more correct, the Sympocarophos orbiculitus. Try saying that after 4 pints of Ruby Mild. An opinion piece by Dr. Roshan Doug. I miss the days when a firm polite handshake would do. Roshan Doug on the complications of greeting in today's modern world. Supporting this article is a picture of two footballers with the caption, "Hugs from Erik Haaland to James Trafford, both who play for Manchester City." Last week, I was on the phone to an American friend chatting about how communication seems to have become extraordinarily complicated in the 21st century. When I was growing up in the 1970s, you met somebody, shook their hand and said hello. If it was a close friend, perhaps you slapped them on the shoulder. In a world of emotionally charged people, I think there is a lot to be said for being aloof, reserved and keeping a stiff upper lip. I grew up in a very conservative Indian family and my father was not a man given to displays of physical affection. I cannot remember him ever giving us a hug. It wasn't because he didn't love us, quite the opposite. He came from a generation in which love was demonstrated through responsibility, sacrifice and looking after your family rather than throwing your arms around people. And my father also believed that passionately, in a man's world, when he bought his first house, he agreed the price with the seller in a pub. They shook hands and that was it. No lawyers, prolonged negotiations or lengthy contracts, a handshake, and that was the generational equivalent of signed, sealed and delivered. Later, my father offered a similar house at a lower price by a man who was eager to sell. He turned it down instantly. "We've already shaken hands," he said to the desperate vendor. The deal had been done. His word was his bond. Today, if you said you bought a house by shaking hands with somebody in a pub, you'd probably be advised to see a psychiatrist. My father was aghast at my first collection of poetry. It had intimate references to my feelings, relationships and love life. Why, he wondered, would any grown man want to broadcast his private life to the whole world? Understandable in a way, in his generation, some things were simply private. Which perhaps explains why I too find the modern male hug slightly curious. Two men, who haven't seen each other for a couple of days, can now approach with arms outstretched and perform what looks to be a carefully rehearsed rugby tackle. I believe men should be men, firm, stoic and steadfast, capable of keeping their emotions reasonably under control. That doesn't mean men shouldn't show affection, of course, they should. But I still like the old-fashioned greeting, a firm handshake, a slap on the shoulder and good to see you, me old mucker. I remember once seeing a grown man on MasterChef crying because he'd made a mess of his cheesecake or something. A grown man, and I can't imagine what my father would think. Then came the kisses. When I was growing up, kissing someone was unheard of in my family. But in European context, two kisses now seems to be a requirement when greeting or saying goodbye. Left cheek, right cheek, or the other way round, I've never mastered the system. The danger comes when your kissing expectations differ. You lean one way, they lean the other way, and suddenly you're engaged in an awkward place of facial choreography and somebody going for a hug whilst you're preparing for a handshake and you have something resembling a failed dance routine. And then there are emojis. We used to use words, now we send tiny yellow faces, expecting people to understand precisely what emotional state we're in. People say they're convenient, I say they're infantilising. Even punctuation has become psychologically charged. Apparently, ending a text with a full stop can make you sound cold. Use ellipses and you're just asking for trouble. Three innocent dots have somehow become sinister. And heavens forbid you use capital letters. Some time ago, an Australian court considered an email from a manager packed with capitals and exclamation marks and found that it conveyed a tone of anger, irritation and frustration, highly unprofessional. I remember when capital letters were simply used at the beginning of sentences. Now they apparently have an emotional temperature and an exclamation mark and you're practically heading for an employment tribunal. Even deaths when received a linguistic makeover. We used to say someone had died, but now we say passed away. Now, increasingly, people simply say someone has passed. Passed what? An examination? GCSEs? It sounds as though there is an entrance test in the pearly gates. Congratulations, you've passed heaven. You're through here. In a world full of technology, we need the human touch. Give me a handshake, a smile, a straightforward hello, and a decent conversation over a cup of tea, and I know where I am with that. The rest feels like it's learning a foreign language for which nobody has bothered to provide the phrasebook. And even when you think you've finally mastered modern communication, someone sends you a picture of two pineapples upside down. As my American friend said, you really don't want to go there because that's a whole new language for a very different community. Health chiefs urge blood donors to come forward after triple whammy. Health officials have urged blood donors to come forward after facing a triple whammy of high demand, the impacts of hot weather and fewer donations. NHS Blood and Transplant said that the boosting donor numbers would see blood supplies in a better position to withstand summer shocks to the system. Following a series of heat waves, the summer blood officials highlighted how even slightly warmer weather can impact a donor's iron levels, meaning fewer people are eligible to donate. Even our normal weather days, donations can reduce by 10% because of donor iron levels. Meanwhile, potential donors may be dehydrated, it added. Regular donations can also be impacted by holidays, childcare and travel deferrals for people who have been overseas. And some patients who need regular transfusions may need more transfusions than usual. NHSBT said that it is seeing higher demand from hospitals during the heatwaves in June and July. Darren Bowe, an assistant director for blood supply at NHSBT, said that summer has been a particularly challenging one for blood services in England, with blood stocks hit by the triple whammy of hot weather, holidays and high demand from hospitals. With hot weather arriving earlier and lasting much longer than we've seen in recent years, it has resulted in lower collections along with increased demand from hospitals, with many patients reliant on regular transfusions for conditions like sickle cell needing more frequent treatments or higher quantities of blood than usual. We urge donors, especially those with B negative, O negative and the RO subtype, as well as more donors of black heritage, to keep coming forward as we work to rebuild stocks. It comes as supply organisations across England, Canada and Australia have come together for the first time to launch an appeal for more blood donors across the three countries as a range of pressures have impacted blood supplies. These include extreme weather and seasonal illness to changing donation patterns, NHSBT said. The organisation has previously issued an urgent call for donors to fill 60,000 appointments over the summer period. Meanwhile, demand for medicines made from plasma to treat immune deficiencies, bleeding disorders and other conditions continue to rise, it said.
Hi, this is Debbie with some articles from the Express and Star from the 27th of August. Bielik departs Albion in £2.5 million Cardiff switch. Defender Christian Bielik has left Albion in a permanent move to Championship New Boys Cardiff City for a fee understood to be around £2.5 million. The experienced 28-year-old only spent 1 year at the Hawthorns, having checked in from Birmingham City on a 3-year contract last summer. But the centre-back was on the fringes throughout his time at the club and found himself down the pecking order again in the early weeks of this season under James Morrison. Bielik's move to South Wales sees the Baggies recoup and pocket some decent profit on the fee of around £1.75 million the defender cost from Blues last summer. The Polish defender played 20 times for Albion, including 13 starts, 11 of which were in the Championship. He has endured injury issues throughout his career and spent spells on the sidelines at the Hawthorns and could not force his way as a first-choice regular under Ryan Mason, Eric Ramsey or Morrison. Bielik's departure sees Morrison's squad left with skipper George Campbell, Nat Phillips and Chris Mepham as senior centre-backs. Campbell and Phillips are first-choice as things stand. Exhibition reveals human cost of war by Dominic Robertson. A new community-led display at the RAF Museum Midlands explores the human cost of war and conflict. The exhibition brings together the personal experiences of civilians who endured the Second World War Blitz in West Bromwich and the wider Black Country, alongside the journeys of people displaced from Ukraine to the Midlands following the 2014 and 2022 Russian invasions. Told through photographs, archive material, personal testimonies and objects, the display connects these two periods of history through the experiences of Joyce Langford, who lived through the Blitz in the Black Country, and Daria Pyroshenko from Kharkiv in eastern Ukraine, who relocated to the UK in 2023. Together, Joyce and Daria's stories show how war can reshape civilian lives, often bringing injury and loss, destroying homes and livelihoods and disrupting the fabric of communities. Their experience also highlights the endurance, resourcefulness and determination of ordinary people striving to protect their families, identity and community while under attack. Co-created with community organisations and volunteers, the display explores themes of destruction, communication and community spirit. People can discover how the destruction caused by bombing affected homes and infrastructure in the Black Country and the impact of attacks on civilian areas in Ukraine. Joyce Langford recalled, "The sirens went off and Mum used to run with me in her arms and the old lady next door and go into the air raid shelter. You had one air raid shelter between two or three houses." The displays compare how vital communication during times of crisis has evolved over time, from wartime letters and air raid precautions messengers to today's messaging apps and digital networks. Daria Parozhenko describes the continuing reality of life in Kharkiv. "Nowadays, the city is under constant attack and destruction has become part of the everyday landscape. Yet the people who remain still deeply cherish the beauty and history of their remarkable town, finding small moments of peace and creating their own moments of happiness in daily life." Grace Rees, head of exhibitions interpretation at RAF Museum, said, "What makes the displaced display particularly special is that it has been developed together with the communities whose experiences it explores." The displaced display was officially opened on Monday with Daria Parozhenko and relatives of Joyce Langford in attendance. This article is accompanied by two colour photographs, one showing Daria Parozhenko in a black outfit with a red necklace standing in front of a photograph of herself in jeans and t-shirt in the display, and the other photograph shows a man and a woman standing in front of an interactive display with a screen. Former pub site available with permission for 32 apartments by James Vukmirovich. Land at a former Black Country pub site with full planning consent for 32 apartments will go under the hammer in Bond Wolf's September auction. The freehold residential development opportunity is located where the Mill Pub used to sit on Beacon View Road in West Bromwich. It will have a guide price of more than £395,000 at the live streamed auction on Thursday, September the 10th. James Mattin, Managing Director and auctioneer at Bond Wolf, confirmed that the potentially lucrative land would be offered at the auction, but that the vendor may consider pre-auction offers. He said this plot of land was previously the location of the Mill Public House, which has been demolished to provide an irregular-shaped parcel of land. The site measures approximately 0.587 acres and comes with full planning permission for the development of 32 apartments, which would carry a gross developmental value of some £4 million. The proposed development will comprise a detached six-storey apartment building providing 32 apartments in a mix of 10 one-bedroomed and 22 two-bedroomed units plus 38 car parking spaces. The land lies in the Charlemont district of West Bromwich, around 2 miles northeast of the town centre, some 2.5 miles east of Wednesbury and 5 miles south of Walsall. The property lies to the west side of Beacon View Road at the corner of the junction with Windmill Crescent, a residential service road. Beacon View Road is accessed from the A4041 Walsall Road and Charlemont Road, and the closest railway station is Tamebridge Parkway, which is within a mile to the north. There is a mixture of commercial and residential property in the immediate neighbourhood, with a parade of local shops to the south of Beacon View Road. The pub was built in the 1960s but fell into disrepair and was targeted by arsonists and abandoned in 2010 before being bulldozed in March 2014. A petition was signed by more than 300 residents at the time calling for the eyesore pub to be pulled down. The auction will be one of 187 lots of the live-streamed auction, which is available via Bond Wolf's website with remote bidding by proxy, telephone or internet. For more details and to register to bid, go to the Bond Wolf website, email auctions@bondwolf.com or call 0121 312 1212 or 01902 928 510. This article is accompanied by a colour photograph with an image, an artist's impression of how the development would look. It's a fairly rectangular cube-shaped building cuboid shaped building in grey and peach and white, and the caption reads, "An image of how the new development would look." Shingles jab used by the NHS could slash heart risks, new study finds. The shingles vaccine currently used by the NHS may slash the risk of heart disease, heart failure and stroke, a new study has found. If all over 60s had the jab, it could prevent tens of thousands of deaths, according to experts. Shingles is a viral infection that causes a painful rash. A jab that protects against the illness, Shingrix, is available on the NHS for people turned 65, those aged 70 to 79, and people aged 18 and over with a severely weakened immune system. The health service previously used a vaccine called Zostavax, but this was replaced by Shingrix almost 3 years ago. Shingrix is a known live vaccine made from a specific protein found on the surface of the virus that causes the illness, making it safer for people with weakened immune systems. Researchers from the University of Oxford compared the risk of heart failure, stroke or ischemic heart disease, where narrowed or blocked heart arteries reduce blood flow and oxygen to the heart, over 7 years in people who had either Zostavax or Shingrix. The team analysed data from more than 70,000 people in the TriNetX electronic health records network in the US, which switched from Zostavax to Shingrix in October 2017. There were 36,000 patients in each group and all were over the age of 60. The study found that up to 7 years after vaccination, people who had Shingrix lived 9% longer without developing a cardiovascular disease. It was also linked to living 10% longer without ischemic heart disease and 12% longer without heart failure. The benefit was seen in both men and women, with men also showing a 12% increase in time lived stroke-free. Dr. Maxime Taquet, Associate Professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Oxford, who led the study, told a briefing, "We find that Shingrix appears to protect against cardiovascular disease in both women and men, and we find that the protective association was most pronounced for ischemic heart disease and heart failure, but less so for ischemic stroke, where the effect was not so sensitively significant. It was, however, significant in males." He suggested that if everyone over 60 in the UK was vaccinated using Shingrix, then over a seven-year follow-up, the number of deaths prevented could be in the tens of thousands. Shingles is caused by the herpes zoster virus flaring up again in people who previously had chickenpox. My visit to the little spring that gave Sandwell its name. This article is accompanied by two colour photographs. One shows a man in trousers and a blue jacket crouching beside a semicircle of stones filled with sand with water at the bottom. The caption for that photograph reads, "Dan at the Sand Well in West Bromwich, the medieval water source that gave the borough its name." And a closer up picture showing the actual water source in the sand well. And the article is written by Dan Stacey. It is a name now associated with six towns, a proud Black Country identity and a borough of more than 300,000 people. But the story of Sandwell's name begins not with industry, canals or Victorian terraces, but with a spring of water. Tucked away in what is now Sandwell Valley Country Park are the remains of Sandwell Priory, a Benedictine monastery founded in the late 12th century. Historic England records that the priory was established on the site of a holy well known as Sandwell, a name recorded in the priory's foundation charter. The simplest explanation for the name is remarkably literal. Sand referred to the sandy ground, while well denoted a spring or source of water. A historical study of Staffordshire place names described Sandwell as the sandy spring, and that spring which gave the place its name still exists today. There is, however, more to the story than a convenient description of the landscape. Before the priory was established, the spring appears to have been an important enough feature to attract religious activity to the secluded spot. The priory's foundation charter specifically mentions the holy well, providing a direct link between the medieval water source and the name that survives today. The monastery subsequently became known as Sandwell Priory, and although it was dissolved in 1525, the name survived. Sandwell Hall was later built on the former priory estate, ensuring that Sandwell remained attached to the landscape for centuries. Then, in 1974, the name took on an entirely new significance. the newly created metropolitan borough brought together communities including Aldbury, Rowley Regis, Smethwick, Tipton, Wednesbury and West Bromwich. Rather than taking the name of one of its larger towns, the new authority was named after the much older Sandwell Priory and estate. That decision was not always universally accepted. In 2002, Sandwell Council held a consultation on whether the borough should retain its name. Although a sizeable proportion of respondents favoured alternatives, particularly West Bromwich, the majority backed keeping Sandwell and the name remained. So when residents today say they live in Sandwell, they are using a name with roots stretching back to medieval England, one that began with a spring bubbling from sandy ground that still exists today.
This is Lauren with some stories from the Express and Star from the 28th of August. Murder case told Dad is an animal, written by Deborah Hardiman, chief reporter. A defendant accused of helping her father to dispose of the body of a woman has told the jury he was an animal. John Anslow is on trial accused of murdering 36-year-old Cherise Bailey of Tipton, whose body was found in a canal off Riders Green Road in West Bromwich on October 7th last year. He is accused of killing her at his home in Stour Street, West Bromwich, and then wheeling and dumping her body in the water with the help of his daughter, Hayley Marie Ferguson. Ferguson of Heronville Road, West Bromwich, appeared at Birmingham Crown Court via video yesterday due to feeling unwell. She repeatedly said she did not see the body at her father's home when she went to visit on September 28th. She said she was forced to help 65-year-old Anslow, whom she said told her that it was his mate who was in the wheelchair and that the person was drunk. Cross-examining her, prosecution junior Miss Sharon By put to her, "You were at his house for 2 to 3 hours. You were dressing her, and after that you were in constant contact with your father." Ferguson, aged 42, replied, "I told Dad to go to the police and he told me to shut my redacted mouth." Re-examining Ferguson, defence barrister Miss Samantha Giffin put to her, "It has been suggested that your dad did not force you to do anything." Weeping aloud as she answered, Ferguson replied, "Yes, he did. He forced me to help. He is an animal." The jury previously heard that Anslow engaged the services of Miss Bailey, an occasional sex worker who lived in Tipton, and had violently attacked her. Anslow had pleaded guilty to the charge of preventing a lawful indecent burial, but denies murdering Miss Bailey. Ferguson, who is not accused of murder, has pleaded not guilty to a charge of preventing a lawful indecent burial, and not guilty to a charge of assisting an offender. The trial continues. Woman left partially blind after medics failed to spot condition. Written by Nathan Pinn. A Dragon's Den contestant who pitched an eyeliner product is now partially blind after medics failed to spot a devastating condition. Noura Lewis, 63, said she lost the sight in her left eye after doctors failed to diagnose giant cell arteritis, GCA, a condition that can cause irreversible blindness if not treated urgently. The former makeup entrepreneur, who appeared on BBC One's Dragon's Den in 2012 with her beauty product Flick Tips, repeatedly reported symptoms including headaches, jawache, tender temples and pain on the right side of her face. After appointments at Birmingham and Midland Eye Centre and City Hospital, Noura was told she had inflammation in her eye and was sent home with steroids. But her vision began to deteriorate before the condition was finally confirmed, almost 4 months after she first sought medical help. By then, it was too late to save the sight in her left eye. After losing her sight, Noura from Birmingham hired medical negligence lawyers Erwin Mitchell to investigate her care. Sandwell and West Birmingham NHS Trust have now admitted a breach of duty, saying there were failures in treating suspected giant cell arteritis. It is also admitted that, with appropriate care, Noura would likely have avoided complications, including the impact on her vision. Noura first attended Birmingham and Midland Eye Centre in May 2021, after 2 GP appointments, but her symptoms continued, and the next month her GP suspected giant cell arteritis and told her to go to hospital immediately. At City Hospital, a doctor noted a lack of pulse in her right temporal artery, a key warning sign of the condition, but did not investigate further and discharged her. She returned to City Hospital on June 14th, where two doctors saw her but did not carry out any investigations into giant cell arteritis, despite her ongoing symptoms. When Nora experienced visual disturbances in her left eye on July 25th, she was admitted to City Hospital and spent 3 days undergoing tests. Her diagnosis was finally confirmed on August 2nd, 2021. Nora now struggles with everyday tasks and relies heavily on family and friends. She said, "When I was finally diagnosed with giant cell arteritis, I felt angry. Thinking back, I had all the symptoms and can't understand why I was left untreated for so long." Dr. Mark Anderson, Group Chief Medical Officer at the NHS Trust, apologised to Nora. He said, "We have acknowledged that aspects of the care provided fell below the standard we accept and have accepted liability in relation to those failings. We recognise the distress caused and the devastating effect that the loss of sight has had and have apologised for this." Alongside this article are two pictures of Nora Lewis. On the left shows her in hospital. It appears to be a selfie in front of a hospital window. She is wearing a gown, a white face mask that covers half her face, and generally looks very sad and disappointed. On the right is a picture of her. She has earrings in, she's dressed up, it's zoomed in. She's standing in the sunlight and smiling. This would appear to be her before and after. It's captioned, "Nora Lewis, who appeared on Dragon's Den, said she lost the vision in her left eye." Andy Burnham announces new crackdown that will put cowboy builders out of business. Andy Burnham has announced a crackdown on cowboy builders, ripping off households and private bailiffs using intimidating tactics against people struggling with debt. Measures will help people find trusted traders through a register and protect their money from unscrupulous operators. Citizens Advice said home renovations were one of its biggest sources of complaints, with more than 1 in 4 adults reporting problems with their most recent project, including shoddy work and builders vanishing before completion. A government-backed scheme being rolled out from September will allow businesses to sign up to an approved code to demonstrate they meet standards on customer service, transparency, and resolving disputes. A new payment system available from next week will also allow customers to avoid upfront costs by linking payments to project milestones. The Prime Minister said, "Cowboy builders don't just rip people off. They leave families with months of stress, the disruption of unfinished work, and that horrible feeling of being taken advantage of. Not only that, but they give the vast majority of decent, hard-working tradespeople a bad name. So we're putting these cowboys out of business. These changes mean you'll now have the option to make sure your money is held safely and released bit by bit as the work gets done. It's the latest in our series of everyday fixes to give people room to breathe and make Britain fairer. We've taken on subscription traps, fake discounts, and now we're coming for the cowboy builders. Enough is enough." Business Secretary Jonathan Reynolds said the changes would protect consumers, support reputable traders, and help families avoid home improvements turning into a nightmare. Ministers also announced tougher regulation of private bailiffs in England and Wales, including mandatory independent oversight. The changes are intended to ensure consistent professional standards amid concerns over enforcement agents pressuring people into repayment arrangements that left them unable to pay for daily essentials. Bailiffs will be required to be accredited by the Enforcement Conduct Board, or work for an accredited firm in order to get the certificate needed to operate. Courts Minister Sarah Sackman said, "Bailiffs have an important job to do, but with that responsibility must come high standards. When someone is already struggling with debt, the last thing they should face is intimidating behaviour or unfair treatment." Hello, everybody. This is not an article from Sandor Talking News. This is just Lauren, because the team over at Sandor Talking News have asked me to record a little thing about something I did recently. So I, in about Easter time, auditioned for the National Youth Theatre and I got accepted in. which means in summer, in August, I did 2.5 weeks of an intensive training course every single day, Monday to Saturday, 10 till 5. We had professional directors who work for the National Theatre, the National Youth Theatre and professional theatre companies come in and train us, teach us loads of things. We created lots of theatre. We created a big show. And they basically wrote notes on me the entire time I was there. I've got no idea what they say. I hope they're good. And that all gets put into this big kind of centralised database. And it means that from now on, if anyone is putting on a show or if any of those directors are putting on a show or they're looking to workshop something or have a big project, they can refer to that and they can say, we're looking for someone who is this age or we're looking for someone who is this kind of person in a rehearsal room. And if my notes are good, I will automatically be recommended and hopefully I will be in way more shows. I know I've been reading for you all for a long time, and even though you can only hear me, you've basically listened to me grow up. And this feels like quite a big thing and maybe will lead to some really exciting stuff. So I just thought I'd let you all know. That's what I've been doing this summer. I've got one more year left of university in York, and then I will see what the world waits for me, see what it's got in store. But that's what I've been up to alongside reading for all of you lovely lot, of course. And yeah, I can't wait to read for the rest of my life.
Hello, everyone. This is Subject with your news from the Express and Star, Saturday, 29 August. Hospices get £5 million deal to help the NHS. By Mark Andrews. There is a picture of Rachel Overfield, CEO of Compton Care. Four hospices have signed a pioneering deal with the NHS to help take seriously ill patients out of hospital beds and return them to loved ones at home. Compton Care is leading a partnership with three other charities to extend its virtual ward service to people across Staffordshire. The £5 million NHS contract is the first of its kind in England and marks a major expansion of services designed to provide speculative palliative care for patients at home. The deal struck with the NHS is being led by Wolverhampton-based Compton Care, which covers the Black Country. It is teaming up with Staffordshire charities, Catherine House Hospice, St Giles Hospice and Dougie Mac. It comes as the chief executive of Compton Care, Rachel Overfield, calls for a radical overhaul of hospice services in the UK, using the expertise of staff to take pressure off the NHS. She said, "By combining our resources and expertise and developing a louder voice, we are creating something bigger than any one organisation could achieve alone, ensuring more people receive the right care and support when it matters most, while helping to ease pressure on wider health services." Compton Care has been running its virtual ward service for a couple of years, helping to release beds in Black Country hospitals. It has specialist teams of medics and nurses who are based in community, offering patients the best treatment available in their own home. That service will now be expanded across Staffordshire in a pioneering deal with the NHS that is likely to lead to similar arrangements elsewhere across England. In an open letter in today's Express and Star, Ms. Overfield says the ways hospices are used needs to be re-imaged. She says, "More than 40% of people die in acute hospitals, often with significant costs linked to repeat visits and admissions. Most people do not want this. They want their final months, weeks or days spent in the place they call home." Albion win race for £3 million former loanee. By Lewis Cox. Albion have won the race to sign Manchester United's Toby Collier in a £3 million deal. The former lone midfielder, aged 22, is due to undergo a medical and become a key signing for the Baggies in the closing days of the summer transfer window. After pipping Middlesbrough and Hull City to the move, the overall deal could rise to £7.6 million, with add-ons including promotion, reaching Europe and Collier playing for England. Albion lost prospective club captain Alex Moat to Championship rivals Derby County on the eve of the new league season, which steered the club towards a new option to bolster the department. Collier endured an injury hit loan at the Hawthorns and with Hull across last season. Muscle injuries limited his action for Albion to just 12 appearances, 3 starts, before a January recall. He went to promotion winners Hull and played just 5 times with 1 start. Despite that, Albion are optimistic the midfielder's injury troubles are a thing of the past. The United prospect, who moved to Old Trafford from Brighton in 2022, underwent a fully fit pre-season and is believed to be ready to go in competitive action. Collier would join a midfield department of Umar Diakite, Jason Malumbi, Felix Horn-Meyer and Rabi Ninzengula. Albion also want another striker before Tuesday night's deadline. It remains to be seen how interested the Baggies are on right-back cover for Nolan Gulls, given the impressive development of Alex Williams, aged 21, who shone at Newcastle in midweek. Dental surgery extension plan is going to appeal. Original application rejected by planners on privacy grounds. By Christian Barnett, local Democracy reporter. There is a picture of complete dental in Bearwood. A dental surgery has turned to government inspectors in a bid to build a 3-storey extension after being rejected by council planners over privacy concerns. Earlier this month, Sandwell Council approved a downscaled application to extend 2 rooms and build 2 new rooms at Complete Dental in Bearwood Road, Bearwood, after previously rejecting proposals for a 3-storey extension with 4 new surgery rooms. Despite receiving planning permission for the smaller extension, Dr. Nikesh Farmer has now appealed to the government's planning inspectors, which can overrule the council, in a bid to get the rejected 3-storey extension approved. The surgery had said the 4 new rooms would help address a significant shortage of appointment slots, but Sandwell Council's planners rejected the first application by Dr. Nikesh Farmer, saying the extension would lead to intrusive overlooking and a loss of privacy for neighbours. Approving the smaller extension earlier this month, the council's planners said the extension would be a sufficient distance from neighbouring properties as to raise no significant concerns, and had addressed the previous reasons for refusal. The massing and scale of the rear extension would be proportionate to the existing property and raises no concerns regarding its impact on the character of the existing property or the visual amenity of the wider area, planners said. However, the dental practice said it needed to extend the building as it was experiencing very high levels of demand, long waiting lists and limited availability for appointments. A statement included with the application by Complete Dental said, "There is significant and ongoing shortage of NHS dental provision across Sandwell and neighbouring areas. Complete Dental is currently experiencing very high levels of patient demand, resulting in long NHS waiting lists and limited appointment availability. Local demand for NHS dental services continues to grow, and the existing size and layout of the premises restrict the practice's ability to meet this need effectively." The statement added, "The proposed expansion is the only realistic means by which the practice can increase capacity, shorten waiting times, and improve NHS patient access." Tram Depot Gets New Communication Centre by Mark Andrews. Two pictures showing staff inside the new communication centre at the tram depot in Wensbury. The building is described as the new nerve centre for tram operations. A new operational control centre has opened at West Midlands Metro's main tram depot in Wensbury in preparation for the opening of the new extension to Dudley. Transport chiefs have described the building as the new nerve centre for tram operations and its integration with the region's wider transport network. It also connects with the upgraded CCTV system covering metro stops and onboard trams, offering improved security. The first trams ran along the 6.5-mile new tram line in June as part of the testing process, although they were not expected to accept passengers until the end of the year, when the testing process is complete. Richard Parker, Mayor of the West Midlands, said, "As we prepare to open the extension to Dudley Town Centre, this new world-class control room ensures we deliver a safer, more reliable and more efficient metro network for the thousands of people who rely on our trams every day." He said the new centre would mean the network would be equipped to handle future extensions to Digbeth, the Maryhill Shopping Centre and the new Birmingham City Football Ground in the coming years. The new centre, which is part of a wider redevelopment of the Wensbury Depot, includes a new data wall offering three times the coverage of the previous system, providing real-time visibility across the network and nearby roads, public spaces and connecting transport services. It also incorporates heat mapping technology and video analytics to detect the build-up of customers or any suspicious behaviour, enabling resources to be deployed quickly and more effectively. Sophie Allison, Managing Director of West Midlands Metro, said, "As well as boosting our already highly effective security measures, the new control centre is essential to the safe and efficient running of a larger, more complex tram system. Operationally, it will help future-proof the network as it continues to grow with more routes and junctions, increased services and a greater number of passengers. A new track has also been installed at the depot to give direct access to the Wensbury to Dudley route and provide greater resilience for tram services. Other upgrades include a vastly expanded stabling area to accommodate the additional trams needed to run the additional routes currently under development, as well as improved facilities for drivers and staff." Hospice care doesn't need saving, it needs reimagining. Rachel Overfield, CEO of Compton Care, on why change is needed in order to transform palliative care. There is a growing sense that hospices are in crisis. Funding pressures are real, demand is rising, and the need for high-quality palliative care and end-of-life care has never been greater. But the future of hospice care cannot be framed only as a question of survival. It must be about transformation. We cannot keep asking for more money from government, communities and stakeholders without also reinventing what we do so that it meets today's needs, not those of 40 years ago. I came into the sector 7 years ago after a long NHS career where I had seen relentless change, a health service trying desperately to keep up with an ageing population, changing expectations, funding pressures and workforce gaps. When I moved into hospice care, whilst recognising the exceptional standards of care being delivered, I was struck by the sector's lack of appetite for transformation and its poor resilience around funding. Obviously, there are great exceptions to this, and there are great examples too of hospice transformation that has led to greater resilience. This, in my opinion, needs to become sector-wide. There is now a welcome national conversation about the future of hospice care, linked to a recognised need within government and NHS leadership to improve palliative care for everyone. As the population ages, more people are dying older and with more complex disease. Demand for specialist palliative care will only grow. More than 40% of people die in acute hospitals, often with significant costs linked to repeat visits and admissions in their last year of life. Most people do not want this. They want their final months, weeks or days to be spent in the place they call home, or somewhere peaceful and away from busy hospital wards. They want timely pain and symptom relief from specialists, access to people who know how to have difficult conversations and have the time to do so, and the chance for life, for whatever time is left, to be lived. The range of services offered by many hospices cannot be matched by the NHS, and it is this range that enables truly holistic care, care that supports life to be lived, while also enabling a peaceful and dignified death. Hospices must be part of this conversation to show the value of what we offer and the role we can play in meeting rising demand for palliative care. We can do more. Many hospices, like many organisations, are facing financial challenges. The cost of specialist care has risen, fundraising is becoming harder, and charitable organisations are competing for support from communities whose household budgets are stretched. We should not minimise these pressures, nor should we shy away from making the case for fair and sustainable public funding for palliative care for all, including in areas of the UK where hospices do not exist or where hospice services are limited. Most palliative care is delivered by the NHS, and hospices must not give the impression that only they can deliver gold standard care. I have worked in hospital trusts where palliative care is exceptional, and I have seen GPs and community staff work tirelessly to support people at the end of life. Even so, the best NHS services cannot offer the full scope of services that hospices do. Any funding discussion should therefore recognise the importance of partnership and of fully funding palliative care wherever it is delivered. But in the hospice sector, we need to talk about more than funding. We need a new model of hospice care, one that retains everything precious about the hospice movement while being brave enough to evolve. That means taking specialist care into communities through virtual wards, reaching people and communities that have not traditionally accessed hospice support, intervening earlier, not only at the very end of life, and seeing hospices as centres of excellence that help people live well for as long as possible. It means keeping people out of hospital. It means structural change. We need to bring the same ambition with which the hospice movement began and apply it to the challenges of today. We need to look at ourselves critically and solve our own problems, rather than constantly looking to others to solve them for us. Are we collaborating enough? Are we sharing costs? Are we being innovative enough? The answer to rising demand and financial challenge cannot be rooted in fear for organisational survival. It should be rooted in ambition for the future and a desire to ensure equitable palliative care for all. And there are many reasons to be optimistic. Our communities support us tirelessly, our staff and volunteers are extraordinary, and our expertise is needed more than ever. We have powerful stories to tell about hospice care, and we need to tell them so more people understand what we offer and how the hospice sector could do more. At Compton, we have been growing and innovating because we see this as part of the solution to financial challenge. We have introduced new, modern services, changed our workforce models, and explored new ways to generate income. Recently, we formed a collaborative with other hospices that is already succeeding where individually we had struggled. We are more financially resilient than for many years, but still dependent on the support of our communities. I want the conversation about hospices to be less about survival and more about transformation, collaboration and ambition. That is where the future of hospice-based palliative care should be, not in preserving the past, but in reimagining hospice care so that more people can live well, die well, and receive the support they need when and where they need it.
Hello everyone, this is Pam reading some articles from the Express and Star, Monday the 31st of August. Drivers warned of bus lane fine. Drivers are being warned they will be hit by fines of up to £70 if they drive through a new bus lane in a Black Country town centre from tomorrow. The restrictions will be imposed on a stretch of road in Blackheath near the new bus station. Closed circuit television cameras have been installed to enforce the new regulations, which will apply to the length of road between Birmingham Road and Long Lane. The new rules come into force on Tuesday. Sandwell Council said the new bus gate, which is also open to pedal bikes and emergency services, aimed to make pedestrians and bus passengers feel safer when shopping in the town centre. Any unauthorised vehicle seen on CCTV driving through the lane will receive a £70 penalty charge notice. This is reduced to £35 if paid within 14 days. Cars, vans and motorbikes will be banned from using the site 24 hours a day throughout the year. Signs have been installed at the start of the prohibited area and a different colour road surface has been installed to warn motorists of the restricted area. Councillor Bob Jones, Sandwell Council's Cabinet Member for Environment and Enforcement, said, "This is about bus passengers and other pedestrians feeling safer when they come to shop in the town centre. People can still drive through Blackheath Town Centre along Market Place via the new road layout that was installed last year. Whether you are travelling in a car or van, by bus, by bike or on foot, now is the perfect time to find out what Blackheath has to offer. Come along and support local businesses and market traders." As part of the government-funded Rowley Regis Towns Fund programme, the new bus station and public space were installed last year to provide a more inviting and accessible town centre, with bus stops in a central place, widened footpaths and new zebra crossings. Investigations continue into death of baby. More than 2 months after a baby was found dead at an industrial site in the Black Country, West Midlands Police have confirmed that there is no new information as officers are continuing to investigate this really sad incident. The body of a baby girl was found in a warehouse in Station Road, Rowley Regis, on June the 25th, with police saying at the time that they believe the child was transported to the site by an unwitting private waste operator. Detectives have used forensic examinations in an effort to identify the baby and to find out how she died. West Midlands Police confirmed that they are continuing to investigate the case. Detective Chief Inspector Kylie Westlake from West Midlands Police's Public Protection Unit said in June, "While we don't yet know what has happened, what we do know is that there must be a mother out there who is in real need of help, and she is our absolute priority at the moment. We have been checking CCTV and speaking to hospitals, but it may be that the mother or someone who knows who she is sees this appeal. I really want to speak to her to make sure that she's okay and to ensure that she can get the help she urgently needs." Speeches in trial of pair accused of dumping body. The jury has heard closing speeches in the case of a man and woman accused of dumping the body of an alleged murder victim in a West Bromwich canal. The decomposing body of 36-year-old Cherise Bailey of Tipton was found in the Walsall Canal off Riders Green Road in West Bromwich on October the 7th last year. She was last seen on September the 27th. On Friday, the jury at Birmingham Crown Court heard closing speeches from barristers representing the defendants. John Anslow, aged 65, of Stour Street, Greets Green, is accused of killing her in a violent attack. His daughter, 42-year-old Hayley Marie Ferguson of Heronville Road, also West Bromwich, is accused of helping to dress and wheel Miss Bailey's body in a wheelchair before tipping her into the water. Anslow, a wheelchair user, denies murdering Miss Bailey, who had been strangled and had facial fractures and bruising to many parts of her body. He has pleaded guilty to a charge of preventing a lawful and decent burial. Ferguson is not on trial for murder and has pleaded not guilty to a charge of preventing a lawful and decent burial and not guilty to a charge of assisting an offender. The trial continues. On this day, 31st of August, in 1422, King Henry V of England died in Vincennes, France, struck down with dysentery. He was succeeded by his 9-month-old infant son, Henry VI. In 1888, Mary Ann Polly Nichols, first victim of Jack the Ripper, was found mutilated in Bucks Row in the East End. In 1900, Coca-Cola first went on sale in Britain. In 1908, at the age of 60 and after a career spanning 43 years, the legendary W.G. Grace retired from first-class cricket. He scored 54,896 runs, which is 126 centuries. He took 2,879 wickets and held 871 catches. In 1936, Elizabeth Cowell, Britain's first woman TV announcer, made her debut at Alexandra Palace. In 1962, Chris Bonington and Ian Clough became the first Britons to conquer the north face of the Eiger. In 1968, Garfield Gary Sobers, later Sir Garfield of Nottinghamshire, became the first cricketer to score 6 sixes off and over at Swansea against Glamorgan. The hapless bowler was Malcolm Nash. In 1969, Rocky Marciano, American world heavyweight boxing champion from 1952 to 1956, who retired undefeated, was killed in an air crash in Iowa. In 1972, American swimmer Mark Spitz won his 5th gold medal at the Munich Olympics. In 1997, Diana, Princess of Wales, was killed in a car crash in central Paris, along with Dodi Fayed. And in 2012, the German manufacturer of anti-morning sickness drug thalidomide apologised for the thousands of children born without limbs as a result of its use.
Hello, this is Jan with some ideas from the gardening expert at the MK Pulse magazine based in Milton Keynes. Last month, we explored how a pond can improve your garden by encouraging many species of wildlife. But autumn officially starts in September, and if you already have one of the water features, this is the time to take extra care of it. When leaves begin dropping from trees, you really don't want them to land in your pond, where they will rot and add to the sludge. In turn, aquatic life will be harmed when the leaves decay, which also affects the colour and quality of the water. A leaf-free pond is a happy pond. Planting grass around the periphery is a smart move, as it will act as a great dust catcher. But as the seasons slowly change, there are many other jobs to turn you into a busy bee in your outside space. Water butts need to be cleaned, and pay attention to your grassed areas. If you have sparse patches, reach for the seed and replenish. Autumn winds can play havoc with your delicate plants and young or fragile trees. Don't wait until problems arrive. Act now in anticipation of high winds by ensuring tree ties and plant supports are doing their job. Preparation is key. If you want a pop of spring colour in your flower beds, bare root wallflowers will survive the winter frost, so plant now and you'll be glad you made the effort when they bloom next year. Crocus, daffodil and bluebell bulbs can all be planted now too. If you grow to eat, there is plenty to do in your vegetable patches, including sowing greens. Broad beans, peas and onions and shallots can all be put in now. And what of fruits? The best plums we've ever tasted were the ones harvested from a very old and very reliable tree belonging to a neighbour. When he would climb up the ladder to reach those at height, he would throw the odd one onto our lawn for us to grab and devour. Later, we would receive a bag full of yummy yellow fruits. Delicious, organic, packed with vitamins and so versatile, they can be used in jams, chutneys, sauces, poached or taken straight from the fruit bowl, as we often did. If you have fruit trees, ensure you pick the produce before winds force the fruits to the ground, where they will bruise and be at the mercy of insects and frost. If you have too many, store them or distribute them. Fresh fruits will be welcomed by neighbours and friends. If you are lucky enough to have a big harvest, you might like to consider donating to a food bank. Whatever you do, please make sure they are used, not wasted. If you are looking forward to putting your feet up this month, you had better think again. Your garden needs you. So, how does your garden grow? Adam Frost from Gardener's World says, save seeds from your plants and save money. And I'd like to talk about saving your tomato seed. Tomato comes from the Aztec word zitomatl. And this year I have grown varieties resistant to blight disease and ones from seeds saved myself. If you find a tomato that you really like, cut it in half, scoop the seeds out with a small spoon and spread them onto kitchen paper to dry. When seeds are dry, leave them on the paper, write the name on it, if you know the variety, and put it away until next year. When the time is right to plant them, cut the paper into bits with some seed on it and plant in a pot to germinate. There's no need to separate them from the paper. You can save any seeds, vegetable, flowers, seeds from a favourite shrub. Not all seeds are suitable, but it's always worth a try, as it saves money, packaging and energy, and gives great excitement when you see those little green shoots popping their heads out of the pot. And this month's top tip is sunflowers are one of the biggest and brightest of the summer blossoms, and they have taken on more meaning as the national flower of Ukraine. They have been embraced as a symbol of support for the embattled country. The flowers signify peace in Ukraine, and many people have shown solidarity by growing the terrific flowers here. If yours are still looking radiant, enjoy them while they continue. But when they bow out, leave the seed heads in situ. Visiting birds will feed on them and be thankful.
DNF Soundings.
Some audio described TV programmes for the next week along with radio programme highlights from Talking News Federation. Search for publications TNF Soundings to hear these directly on their website.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, this is Val from Wharfdale Talking News with my selection of audio described TV programmes for the period Saturday the 5th to Friday the 11th of September 2026. So let's get started with Saturday the 5th of September. On Channel 4 this morning, there are the usual three episodes of Frasier starting at 9:20 and five episodes of The Simpsons starting at 10:50. On BBC Two, there's another chance to catch last Tuesday's episodes of both The Great British Sewing Bee at 12 noon and Race Against the Tide at 1:45. Four episodes of Midsummer Murders on ITV1 today at 2:25, 4:15, 6:10 and 8:10. The sci-fi adventure Jurassic World is the afternoon film on ITV1 at 4:50pm. Celebrating Disney at the Proms, The Music of Menken on BBC Two at 5:30 p.m. is a special prom from the Royal Albert Hall. Lives Hang in the Balance in the first of two special episodes of Casualty, 40th Anniversary, on BBC One at 8 p.m. The Box on ITV One at 8:15 p.m. is a new game show hosted by Gary Lineker, where 10 celebrities are plunged into the unknown. It continues tomorrow at 8 p.m. A night of shows marking the 80th anniversary of the birth of Freddie Mercury starts with a selection of classic performances by his band Queen. Queen at the BBC is at 9 p.m. on BBC Two. The Spirits send Alison into meltdown in this episode from 2022 of the sitcom Ghosts on BBC One at 9:40 p.m. On to Sunday, 6th of September. Sunday with Laura Koonsberg is on BBC One at 9 a.m. Interviews with key politicians and public figures. Today's afternoon films are Back to the Future on BBC One at 2:45 p.m. and over on ITV One at 3:05, the Bond film A View to Kill. Katie Durham introduces a night of all-American classics from the Royal Albert Hall in the BBC Proms at 6 p.m. on BBC Two. Several choices at 9 tonight. Amy arrives to help Kirsten when she finds herself facing the wrath of the Russians. The vigil continues on BBC One at 9 p.m. Counter-terrorism officers make a breakthrough and send Lana and her team to a disused workshop to find details of the bomber's next steps. Trigger Point is on ITV One at 9. In 24 Hours in Police Custody, The Ambush on Channel 4 at 9, officers continue their investigation into the case of a teenager left fighting for his life after being found with catastrophic head injuries at the side of a road. Paul Newman and Robert Redford star in the Western film Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid on BBC Two at 10 p.m. After killing somebody in a hit-and-run accident, a lawyer and her brother attempt to cover up their crime. The new Australian comedy series Reckless is on ITV One at 10:15 p.m. Here are those programmes which are on at the same time throughout the week. Homes Under the Hammer is at 11:30 a.m. and Bargain Hunt is at 12:15 p.m. on BBC One, Monday to Friday. On ITV One, Dickinson's Real Deal is at 2 p.m. Monday to Wednesday. On Channel 4, there are four episodes of the sitcom Frasier starting at 9:10 each morning, Monday to Friday. And on ITV3, there are two episodes of Heartbeat starting at 5:50 and 6:55 p.m. Monday to Friday. Now for Monday, 7th of September. It's quiz night on BBC Two with Mastermind at 7:30 and University Challenge at 8:30. We visit a luxury safari lodge in one of South Africa's largest wildlife reserves, in Fred's Ultimate Hotels on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. The vigil continues on BBC One at 9 p.m. As tensions rise and new allegiances are formed, the dangers of the Arctic become apparent when a storm closes in. In tonight's episode of Trigger Point on ITV One at 9, rumours fly of a coming catastrophe. A new series of the Australian sitcom Colin from Accounts returns tonight on BBC Two at 10 p.m. Gordon and Ashley are determined to move on from the embarrassment of his proposal. The late-night film on BBC One at 11:10 tonight is the period biographical drama Testament of Youth, based on the memoirs of Vera Brittain. Tuesday, 8th of September. The teams work in gale force winds to create sand sculptures of monsters in tonight's episode of Race Against the Tide on BBC Two at 7:30 p.m. The judges set the contestants three challenges celebrating wardrobe heroes in this week's episode of The Great British Sewing Bee on BBC One at 8 p.m. The Red Car crew rescue two stranded walkers in Saving Lives at Sea on BBC Two at 8 p.m. The nine semi-finalists are tasked with providing a banquet for 120 diners, and it's a race against the clock, as once the sun sets, the food must be served. Celebrity MasterChef is on BBC One at 9 p.m. The trauma team treats two casualties from a head-on collision on a dual carriageway. Emergency 24/7 is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. As the restaged trial continues, attention turns to older brother Luke. The jury, 14 and on trial for murder, is on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. Gordon invites Ash and her eager new boyfriend David to his birthday party. The sitcom Calling from Accounts is on BBC Two at 10 p.m. Now on to Wednesday, 9th of September. More items requiring some TLC from the experts are brought into the repair shop on BBC One at 8 p.m. The broadcaster joins a team of historians and geologists to recreate the journey along the Colorado River undertaken by John Wesley Powell in 1869. Operation Grand Canyon with Dan Snow is on BBC Four at 8 p.m. The remaining celebrities must create a layered dessert that requires precise timing and temperature control. Find out how they get on in Celebrity MasterChef on BBC One at 9 p.m. The documentary Britain's Forgotten Girls on BBC Two at 9 p.m. brings together shocking accounts of the widespread exploitation and abuse of young girls all across Britain over decades. Jasper is called in after an actor is stabbed on stage with a switched prop knife. Professor T is on ITV One at 9 p.m. The time has come for the jury to deliberate on a verdict on each of the brothers in tonight's episode of The Jury, 14 and on trial for murder, on Channel 4 at 9. Having anticipated Hugh's plan, Patrick flees during a tense drive across the moors. The final episode of the drama The Game is on Channel 5 at 9. Now for Thursday, the 10th of September. The comedy drama Steel Magnolias, starring Dolly Parton, is the early evening film on Film 4 at 6:40 p.m. More entrepreneurs seek the backing of the panel in Dragon's Den on BBC One at 8 p.m. In the semi-final, the would-be art dealers climb aboard the luxury cruise liner Queen Anne to spend 3 days at sea working to a specific brief, as they enter the world of art curation. The Big Deal with Steph McGovern is on BBC Two at 8 p.m. A heartbroken newlywed seeks a second opinion for his spaniel. The Yorkshire Vet is on Channel 5 at 8 p.m. Lucy carries out some last-minute undercover work to prepare for what lies ahead and needs her brother-in-law's support. The drama Ludwig is on BBC One at 9 p.m. Davina and Nikki help two people who are searching for their sisters on behalf of their respective mothers. Long Lost Family is on ITV One at 9 p.m. The contestants venture away to a special location. Taskmaster is on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. And so we come to Friday, the 11th of September. Kevin MacLeod meets a couple who are spending £700,000 to build a curved glass family home. But when the COVID-19 pandemic hits, they face financial ruin with little to show for it. Grand Designs is on More 4 at 7:55 p.m. In the last semi-final, the remaining cooks face a brand new challenge, the MasterChef auction, where time counts more than ever before. who will take a step closer to being crowned this year's champion. Celebrity MasterChef is on BBC One at 8 p.m. Gaynor Fay overcomes a lifelong fear of horses, while farmer Stephen Short hopes his lambs fetch strong auction prices. A new series of Our Great Yorkshire Life starts tonight on Channel 5 at 8 p.m. As Rudy and Deck look for a missing nurse, the investigation suggests a sinister conspiracy may be at play. The Rainmaker is on ITV1 at 9 p.m. In this episode of Father Brown on the U and Drama Channel at 9 p.m, Brenda might have fallen for a killer. An ex-soldier is blackmailed back into action when his daughter is kidnapped. Commando is the 9 o'clock film on Film 4. Agnes's attempts to convince a health inspector that Grandad is losing his marbles is shown in Mrs. Brown's Boys on BBC One at 9:30 p.m. I hope you found something to interest you from this week's selection.
Now for some national radio programmes that might be of interest in the week beginning Saturday, September the 5th. Not surprisingly, there's quite a focus on the events on 9/11, 25 years ago, when the Twin Towers were destroyed along with so many lives. It's one of those events where people can recall exactly where they were at that moment. I certainly can. I know which office in London I was visiting, who I was talking with, even which desk and screen we were called over to. Anyway, let's start with some programmes that are going to be broadcast on Saturday, September the 5th. First, a programme with a rather strange name. It's been around a while now. It's called You're Dead to Me. Greg Jenner is joined in medieval England by a Dr. Erin Gores and a comedian, Alison Spittle, to learn about the tumultuous events of 1066 and the three men who battled for the English throne: Harold Godwinson, the Norwegian King Harald Hardrada, and William, Duke of Normandy. That's on Radio 4 at 10 a.m. Staying with the same channel, The Week in Westminster, that's at 11 a.m, and From Our Own Correspondent at 11:30, both on Radio 4. If you're interested in politics or the world, one or other of those will help you through the week. Switching now to Radio 3's Essential History of Classical Music, we go back in time to 1816. A stolen metronome leads to one of the most influential inventions in music history. That's the device, of course, which offers to musicians something they've never possessed before, a precise and portable way of measuring tempo. And there are various extracts and full pieces of music in this to illustrate the argument. That's on Radio 3 at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. There's a very interesting comedy drama planned for the afternoon. It's called Range Anxiety. It's a comedy drama written by Tim Crouch and Toby Jones. A father volunteers to drive his daughter through the night to the airport, from where she will leave to the other side of the world. As he listens to the car radio, he finds that the programmes seem to be mirroring all of his anxieties. It stars Toby Jones himself and Sophia Oxenham and features the voice of Radio 4 presenters as themselves. That's Range Anxiety on Radio 4 at 3 o'clock. Now to Sunday the 6th of September, and the first of the many programmes referring to the 9/11 attacks. This is The Reunion, recorded in New York. Kirsty Walk is joined by a group of people who describe their experience of the events of the 11th of September. The guests include a battalion chief at the New York City Fire Department, someone who was working in the North Tower, someone whose husband Jim's office was on the 86th floor, a former police officer, a hospital paramedic, a rear admiral who coordinated the evacuation of an estimated 500,000 people from Manhattan Island, and the novelist A.M. Holmes, a longtime resident of New York who witnessed the events unfold from her apartment in Lower Manhattan. That's The Reunion on Radio 4 at 10 a.m. Moving to the afternoon, the return of the Youth Club. Journalist and former youth worker Neil Maggs looks at the fall and rise of youth clubs and explores new government plans to spend £500 million on revitalising the youth sector. That's the return of the Youth Club, 1:30, Radio 4. That's followed by Gardener's Question Time as a regular Sunday afternoon listening. After that, Opening Lines. John York explores the things they carried by Vietnam War veteran Tim O'Brien, which reflects on the nature of experience and memory. That's at 2:45 and is immediately followed by part one of a two-part dramatisation. This is called The Things They Carried, and it's a dramatisation of Tim O'Brien's 1990 novel, which was discussed just earlier in the previous programme. It's about a conscript in the Vietnam War who's confronted with the brutal realities of being a soldier. As a warning, some very strong language. The Things They Carried, Radio 4, 3 p.m. The Power of the Bayeux Tapestry. In this, George Parker explores the political influence and diplomatic power of the Bayeux Tapestry over the centuries. Of course, it's much in the news because it's now on display in London. The Power of the Bayeux Tapestry is at 7:15 on Radio 4. Word of Mouth, the regular programme. This is how the Normans changed the way we speak. And here, Michael Rosen explores the impact of the Norman invasion on the English language. He asks Dr. Philip Durkin about the influence of Anglo-Norman, the dialect of French that was used in Britain after the conquest for around 300 years. That's Word of Mouth, How the Normans Changed the Way We Speak, 8 p.m. on Radio 4. And now for those programmes which are on radio throughout the week, Monday to Friday. Just go quickly to Radio 3 to say that the composer of the week, this week, throughout on Radio 3, is Stephen Sondheim. He was born in 1930 and he died in 2021. Very well known for many different sorts of music. Also running through the week, of course, there's plenty of BBC proms almost every day. Now over to Radio 4 for programmes that are run throughout the week. You Do Not Have to Say Anything. This is a continuation of last week's series, and it's called Telling Stories. And Joanna Hardy-Suskind reflects on the moment when a case finally enters the courtroom where two narratives will be told. 12 people, selected at random, must decide which narrative to believe. So that's You Do Not Have to Say Anything, 11:45 on Radio 4 all through the week. A 9/11 story also continues the series from last week. Investigative journalist Jane McMullen explores why so many families are still battling for the truth 25 years after the events of 9/11. That's a 9/11 story, 1:45 on Radio 4. Every afternoon through the week, you have a different drama at the same time. It's 2:15 on Radio 4. The book at bedtime this week is The Villa Forgotten. It's a new series, and Jeanette Winterson reads her original story written for radio. Upon her uncle's death, Tony inherits the Villa Forgotten, but all is not as it seems, and it's time for her to confront her family's history. This is The Villa Forgotten, book at bedtime, 10:45 p.m. on Radio 4. Now for the programmes that are uniquely on Monday the 7th of September. Café Hope is a return of a series from the past. It's a new series, though, 10-part series. And the first part tells us about a woman who decided to create the charity Emmy's Kitchen after her daughter Emmy had to stay in hospital, and she saw how other parents reacted to the home cooking she was bringing in for her family. That's Café Hope, 9:45, Radio 4. I'm sure most of us remember the fall and rise of Reginald Perrin. Radio 4 Extra has a dramatisation of the original tales created by David Nobbs back in the 1970s. This is on Monday and on Tuesday, 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock on Radio 4 Extra, both days. There's another new series called Rethink, The Future of Cities. The United Nations estimates that nearly half of the world's population will live in cities by 2050. As those cities have grown, the number of people living in the slums has also increased. And the UN estimates that 1.2 billion people reside in so-called informal settlements. Well, this is about the possibility of building new cities funded by entrepreneurs and foreign investment. It's called Rethink. It's a new series, and the first part is called The Future of Cities. Tuesday the 8th of September sees the return of the Life Scientific and a new series. Jim Al-Khalili talks to fellow scientists about their life and work, starting with a physicist by the name of Ginger Kerrick. She was NASA's first Hispanic female flight director. The Life Scientific, Radio 4, 9 a.m. And that's followed by All in the Mind, a new series as well. In an exclusive Radio 4 interview, clinical psychologist Tanya Byron argues that the increasing adoption of mental health language is just one way in which the line is being blurred between everyday emotional struggles and genuine mental health conditions. Well, that's what's explored in All the Mind, 9:30 a.m. Radio 4. History's Secret Heroes began a couple of weeks ago, and this week's part is about Airy Neave and his escape from Colditz Castle. Captured by the Nazis, Lieutenant Airy Neave is sent to Colditz Castle, a high-security prisoner of war camp in Germany. No British captive has ever escaped from here before, but after months of preparation and armed with a careful disguise, can he evade the notorious guard patrols and their dogs? I think we know the story. History's Secret Heroes, 3 o'clock, Radio 4. Last Frames, the story of Bill Biggart. At 8:46 on the morning of 11th of September 2001, the photojournalist Bill Biggart was out with his wife, Wendy, walking their dogs near their home on Union Square, when a passing taxi driver told them that a plane had hit one of the World Trade Center towers. Bill went home, grabbed his cameras and headed to the scene, and Wendy would never see him again, as he was killed when the North Tower collapsed. But the photographs he took on that day survived. That's The Last Frames, the story of Bill Biggart, 4 p.m. Radio 4. And of course in the evening, In Touch, Peter White brings you news, views and information in a regular series that we all know very well, 8:45 p.m. Radio 4. That's followed by Crossing Continents, part 6 of a 9-part series. Russian is the first language of millions of Ukrainians, but its public use is now restricted by law, with ever more measures to enforce communication in Ukrainian. As the language laws anger many in primarily Russian-speaking places such as Odessa, Tim Yule reports on the divisions in a city under persistent Russian bombardment. That's Crossing Continents, 9 p.m. Radio 4. Moving on to Wednesday, the 9th of September. Where is Austin Tice? This is a new series. We Believe He's Alive explores the events surrounding one of the biggest missing person cases of recent times. American journalist Austin Tice vanished in Syria in 2012. And for more than a decade, Austin's mother, Deborah, has been leading the search for her son. Two investigative journalists travel to Syria to help with Deborah's search, and then a source provides some information that might unlock where Austin is. That's 9:30 a.m. on Radio 4. Of course, don't forget that every afternoon at 2:15, from Monday to Friday, there's the afternoon drama on Radio 4. In the evening, The Moral Maze, a regular programme in which Michael Burke is joined by others to discuss the moral aspects of a topical issue. That's The Moral Maze, 8 o'clock on Radio 4. And slightly later, Posters of Montmartre. Now, this is an interesting 15 minutes on Radio 4 Extra. It's at 9 o'clock on each of 4 days, so it's this weekend into next week. Posters of Montmartre is actually 4 plays based on the characters in the posters of Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec, French painter who lived from 1864 to 1901. In the first, Bonnie Langford plays Irish singer May Balfour, who realises as her stardom begins to fade that her talents lie elsewhere and vows to open her own bordello. Further adventures from Paris during the Belle Epoque come later in the week, when the series continues with Miranda Richardson as the revolutionary Marie Briand in Casque d'Or, and Bernard Hill as legendary cabaret singer and club owner Aristide Bouhans. This is at 9 o'clock in the evening and at 3 p.m. in the afternoon on BBC Radio 4 Extra. Thursday the 10th of September, LA rising from the ashes. In a documentary first broadcast earlier this year, Jonathan Glancy meets the architects who are leading Los Angeles' recovery from the catastrophic fires of 2025 and finding out how they're looking for better ways to build in an area where earthquakes, drought and fire are an ever-present threat. That's 9:30 a.m. Radio 4. This Cultural Life, John Wilson talks to cultural figures about their formative experiences. Today's guest, actor Ray Winston. This Cultural Life, 11 a.m. on Radio 4. Saving the Rare Plants of the Snowdonia National Park. I'm dodging trying to pronounce the Welsh name for it. Martha Carney meets the people who are protecting and restoring rare Arctic alpine plants in this national park. She talks to people who are saving it, who are propagating species such as previously extinct
plants and also meets naturalists in the environment. That's Open Country, 3 p.m. on Radio 4. Shortly afterwards, Word of Mouth, Bias Against Women's Voices. Michael Rosen is joined by a phonetician, Jane Setter, to talk about negative attitudes to vocal traits seen as exclusively female. That's Word of Mouth with Michael Rosen, 3:30, Radio 4. 9:45, The Cows Are Mad. This is the final part of this series, and it's called Zombie Deer. If you've been following it, Lucy Proctor concludes her look at bovine spongiform encephalopathy. Videos of crazed deer crashing through the US countryside were gaining attention online. The animals had the deer version of BSE, chronic wasting disease. It spread to Northern Europe too. History repeated itself as hunters speculated on origin theories and conspiracy theories about a hoax or cover-up spread online. That's The Cows Are Mad, the final part, 9:45, Radio 4. Finally, Friday the 11th of September, the fateful day, 9/11. Rare Earth looks at the wonderful world of the octopus. Now, when Cornish fishermen found that octopuses had replaced their usual catch of lobster and crab this summer, restaurant menus had to be rewritten across southwest England. Tom Heap and Helen Shersky explore why the octopus has moved north and what its journey can reveal about the changing oceans at Rare Earth, just after the midday news on Radio 4. And after the play in the afternoon, there's a new series called When Banksy Comes to Town. It's a tale of two Banksys this week. James Peake meets Sam in Margate and Gert in Lowestoft, who reveal what happened when they woke up one morning to find one of Banksy's pieces painted on the side of their houses. When Banksy Comes to Town, 2:45 p.m. Radio 4. That's followed, of course, by Gardener's Question Time, which is repeated on Sunday. There's a regular Any Questions. Alex Forsyth chairs the political forum from the Kenton Theatre in Henley-on-Thames, Oxfordshire, as an audience canvasses the opinions of four leading figures. That's Any Questions with Alex Forsyth at 8 p.m. on Radio 4. And that's followed by This Week in History. A look back at events from this week in years past, including the assassination of Bulgarian writer, journalist and defector Georgi Markov in London in 1978, and the raising into position of Cleopatra's Needle on the Thames Embankment in London in 1878. That's This Week in History at 8:55 p.m. Radio 4. And that wraps up the week. Friday, 11th of September, a notable date. And I hope you enjoy various programmes during the 7 days.
TNS Soundings.
Albion Match Report. Albion were beaten 3-1 at Middlesbrough in a Saturday lunchtime Sky Bet Championship clash. Will Lancashire's double and Alfie Jones's late strike gave Borough all 3 points, despite JJ Morgan's goal, and inflicted a first league defeat of the season on the Baggies. James Morrison's men are back in home action on Wednesday when they host Charlton Athletic. The visitors largely controlled proceedings during the first half, though their long spells of possession didn't quite translate into clear-cut chances. The most notable opportunity was a good move that saw Jason Malumbi play in Felix Horn-Meyer, but his finish went wide. Down the other end, Middlesbrough created a few chances without scoring either. Riley McGree twice fired off target, while Lancashire also saw an attempt block just before the break. But it was Lancashire who netted straight after the restart, following home Morgan Whittaker's shot, which had struck the post. And the Baggies had to dig in to avoid conceding again. Max O'Leary excellently stopped Ousmane Diakite's accidentally scoring an own goal, and also kept out Callum Britton's header among a dangerous Borough period. Morrison's side got through those tough moments and found a leveller via Morgan. The informed striker met Price's pinpoint cross to loop a header over Radek Vitek for his fourth competitive goal of the season. However, the game changed direction once more 17 minutes from time. Lancashire converting another rebound to net his second against his former club. The host then made it three as Alfie Jones's effort squeezed through with a couple of minutes left.
Hi, this is Kate and I'll be reading you some articles from the Express and Star, the 1st of September. Shaun the Sheep tribute is among the winter storm names. Met offices in the UK, Ireland and Holland picked their choices for months of 2026 to 27. Austin, Beaulieu and Chloe will be the first named storms of this winter, meteorologists have revealed, after more than 40,000 suggestions were submitted by the public. The UK's Met Office, in partnership with Ireland's Met Éireann Forecasting Service, KNMI, has announced the list of storm names for the 2026-27 season, with many people putting forward suggestions in tribute to loved ones and favourite pets. People submitted names in honour of a five-year-old weather enthusiast, a much-loved Labrador puppy, meteorological pioneers and Shaun the Sheep from popular animation Wallace and Gromit. But the Met Office has said that the purpose of naming storms is also as serious as it helps people to take notice, prepare and stay safe in the severe weather. The organisations have been naming storms since 2015, with the list running from early September to the following August. It coincides with the start of the autumn, when the likelihood of low pressure systems and the potential for storms severe enough to be named increases. In the last year, four names were used from the list, reaching the letter D with Storm Dave on the 1st of April, although the UK also saw impacts from further three storms named by other European meteorological services, Storms Benjamin, Claudia and Goretti. Under naming conventions used for storms in the North Atlantic, the list runs alphabetically, missing out Q, U, X, Y and Z. The third name in this year's list, Chloe, was selected by the Met Office after being put forward more than 120 times, including the mother of a five-year-old weather enthusiast who's fascinated by the weather, but can also create a storm all by herself when she's tired. We all know that one, don't we? Another name, Finn, was suggested for a two-year-old boy described by his family as wild and a force to be reckoned with, whilst Ivy was nominated in honour of a nine-month-old Labrador puppy affectionately known as the Absolute Destructor. Nicola was put forward as a tribute to a mother who had weathered many a storm and only come out stronger, while Theo was inspired by a cat who would hide before thunderstorms, leading his owner to joke that he could predict the weather. Shaun was also joined on the list, following a public vote that was run as part of a collaboration with the British animation studio Aardman, which was behind the beloved show Wallace and Gromit. The aim of the collaboration was to reach new audiences and encourage conversations on preparedness for severe weather by combining the Met Office's forecasting expertise with Aardman's storytelling. To mark the 90th anniversary, Met Éireann selected names that celebrated figures from its history, including Austin, in honour of Austin Nagle, the first director of the Irish Meteorological Service, and Evelyn Murphy, the first woman to present the weather on Ireland's National Public Service broadcaster, RTE. Meanwhile, KNMI picked names from more than 3,000 suggestions submitted by the public, including Beaulieu, a nearly extinct name of the East Gregonian region that has since been passed down through the nominator's family for generations. Holly Clements, Met Office Head of Warnings and Guidance, said, "For more than a decade, storm naming has helped us communicate the risks from severe weather more effectively. A named storm provides a very clear focus for forecasts and warnings, helping more people understand the potential impacts and take action to protect themselves, their families and their property." The Met Office said that a number of factors were considered for including a name on the list, including how difficult it is to produce, if it has different meanings across the different countries, is connected to a public figure, or could be controversial in any way. Storms are given a name when they are deemed to have the potential to cause medium or high impacts in the UK, Ireland, or the Netherlands, with wind the primary focus, although additional issues from rain or snow will also be looked at. The new names coincide with the 90th anniversary of the establishment of the Irish Meteorological Service, known as Met-Aerium. And this article is supported by a photograph of some women trying to walk down the street who are clearly in the middle of a storm. The hair's blowing everywhere. They've got coats on with the hoods up. And there's also a picture within the picture of some of the storm names that have been chosen by the relevant areas for 26 and 27. Arrest made as two people are hurt in disorder. Two men were arrested on suspicion of assault following reports of a disorder on a residential road in the Black Country. Police rushed to Tame Road in Albury in the early hours of yesterday morning. West Midlands Police confirmed that a man and a woman in their 50s were injured due to this incident. Their injuries are not deemed as life-changing. Following this incident, two men, one aged 33 and another 59, were arrested on suspicion of assault following two separate incidents. The 33-year-old man has been bailed, while the 59-year-old man remains in police custody. A spokesman for the West Midlands Police said, "We were called to Tame Road, Albury, shortly after 1:05 a.m. on the 31st of August to report of a disorder. A man and woman, both in their 50s, were injured, but thankfully their injuries were not life-changing. Two men aged 33 and 59 have both been arrested on suspicion of assault following two separate incidents. The 33-year-old has been bailed, while the other man remains in custody for questioning," added the West Midlands spokesperson. Flu vaccine is rolled out ahead of a long winter. Children and pregnant women can get their flu vaccinations from today to ensure that they are protected ahead of winter. Jabs will be given in a range of locations across the West Midlands, including pharmacies and mobile vans, to make it easier for patients to access jabs, NHS England has said. Thousands of children each winter end up in the hospital with flu, while pregnant women also face a higher risk of becoming seriously ill. It's given to youngsters in September as the virus can spread quicker in this age group. School-aged children will have the vaccine given as a nasal spray in schools, whilst the parents of 2 to 3 year olds will be invited through their GP practice. Almost 19 million people in the UK had their flu vaccinations last winter, according to the NHS, helping to avoid around 104,000 hospital admissions. Dr. Amanda Doyle, National Director for Primary Care and Community Services at NHS England, said, "Flu can really knock you for six, and for some children and pregnant women, it can become seriously ill or ending up in hospital. Other eligible groups, such as people over 65 with long-term conditions, care home residents and carers, will start receiving their jabs from October." Decision to be appealed on a 9-bed HMO plans. The decision to refuse plans for a 9-bed HMO on Smethwick Street is being appealed. An application was submitted to Samwell Council for plans to convert a property at 1 Queen Street, Smethwick, into a 9-bed HMO in May. Samwell Council rejected the proposal in July after receiving a waiver of objections from neighbours. A total of 64 objections were lodged with the council during public consultation, and the authority's planners received a 100-signature petition against the new HMO. An online petition opposing the HMO was signed by more than 700 people. Objectors said the HMO was out of character for the area and would result in more noise and create the potential for antisocial behaviour. The online petition warned the HMO would disrupt the harmony and safety the community had cherished for years. Samwell Council's planners rejected the proposal, agreeing with objectors that it would lead to greater disturbances. However, residents have now received letters stating that the decision is still being appealed. The council letter, seen by the Express and Star, reads, "I'm writing to let you know that an appeal has been made to the planning inspectorate in respect of the above site. The appeal follows refusal by this council. The appeal is to be determined on the basis of written representations. The procedure to be followed is set out in Part 1 of the Town and Country Planning Appeals Written Representations Procedure, England, Regulations 2009. As this appeal is proceeding under the Part 1 of the process, there is no opportunity for you to submit comments. However, we have forwarded all of the representations made to us on the application to the Planning Inspectorate and the appellant." Public divided over funding for social care. Just under a quarter of people would support the introduction of an additional tax specifically to fund social care, although young people are less likely to favour such an approach, new research has revealed. Prime Minister Andy Burnham has pledged to make fixing adult social care one of his top priorities. He said, "Difficult decisions could be needed on tax, but that fixing the current problems in social care in England could save the NHS billions of pounds a year." Mr Burnham said it was a major dereliction of public duty that successive governments have failed to address the crisis in social care. A UK survey of 2,238 people for the Health Foundation think tank, carried out before Mr Burnham entered number 10, found 23% of people would support an additional tax specifically earmarked for social care, but while just 12% of 25 to 44-year-olds were in favour of this option. Almost a third of people aged 55 years and older favoured it. A similar proportion said that they would support cuts in spending on other services to fund social care. However, almost a fifth think the government should not increase spending on social care, according to a poll.
Albion Match Report. Albion were held to a 1-1 draw by Charlton Athletic on Wednesday evening. Callum Styles' sublime strike had given the Baggies a well-deserved lead around the hour mark, but Tyrese Campbell's 69th-minute leveller earned them a share of the Sky Bet Championship points. It was a frustrating first period for the hosts, who had more than 70% possession but couldn't break down their resilient opponents. Callum Styles and new signing Kareem Tunde, making his home debut, both fired wide inside 21 minutes. Some quick thinking then probably created Albion's best opening, as JJ Morgan's free kick saw Isaac Price played in. The Northern Ireland international attempted his trademark curled finish and goalkeeper Arthur Okonkwo to push the shot away. They continued to control the game without creating another clear-cut opportunity before half-time, while also ensuring Charlton were kept quiet. Price saw one deflected just over straight after the break, and Okonkwo was called into action again to keep out substitute Rabbi Nzingula's powerful effort. The consistent pressure finally paid off, though, around the hour mark. Charlton could only clear an Albion corner to the edge of the box, where Styles controlled the ball and found the top corner with a superb half volley. However, the away side equalised from their first real chance via Campbell, the forward netting to capitalise on a counter-attack and making it 1-1. James Morrison turned to his bench, introducing striker Orn Hegbo and Barney Stewart during the final stages. yet they couldn't find a winner, leaving the points to be split.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello again, it's Liz from East Kilbride. My choice today for a chat with you all is Dolly Parton. Now, if you're one of the very few people on planet Earth who hasn't heard of Dolly, then please keep listening, because this chat, in the time I have, rather than being all about her endless multi-million selling musical songs, it's much more a focus in the time I have on the work, the philanthropy and the amazing effort that she has put into helping others through the money she has made from these world famous songs. Of course, we all know the poor background, born in Tennessee, the fourth child of a family of 12. Her own father couldn't read or write. Now, there's a link to some of her later work. But it was music, musical talent, that gave her self-confidence, which gave her a path into the fame through the Grand Old Opry, working with Porter Wagoner, and then going further afield, away from the idea of just appealing to country music fans, to become this internationally famous superstar. One of the aspects of Dolly, which I also want to say, is just how self-aware she is. As she famously said, "I don't get affected by dumb blonde jokes because, you know I'm not dumb, and I also know I'm not a blonde." So even from those early days, Dolly was a woman of wisdom and a woman of great mirth, in fact. "I'm a self-made woman," says Dolly, "and I have the doctor bills to prove it." Now, those early successes and the continuing success over decades has given her the money and also the platform to use that money. Some particular themes arise. She wants to help children. Now, you can throw money at things or you can think about it. I think she's always been a very astute woman. And the dream was channel the money towards projects or people where it would be most useful. So many years ago, when she saw the success and she saw the money coming in, she set up the Dollywood Foundation. Now, this is a non-profit organisation which in itself is providing hundreds of jobs because, of course, the bids come in from projects all over America, and indeed it's become sought after money from all over the world. They look at the bids, they consider where the money should go, and then it goes out. In particular, she's trying to check that money goes towards education. She has a very strong scholarship program all across America and an innovative idea called the Buddy Program, where kids are put forward for this money, but they go in pairs. And the idea is you have one student who is really quite keen to do well in the exams that are coming up, and they are paired with someone who's maybe a bit more of a reluctant learner. And she's very basic about it. What will make them work harder? It's money. But the deal is they both have to graduate. So a bit of peer pressure used in a very positive way. And it's been very, very successful, especially across the less wealthy parts of America. She's very focused on nature conservation, and in the recent dreadful wildfires in Tennessee, set up My People Fund, trying to restore the homes, restore the habitats, and restore the livelihoods of the people in our home state. A fun aspect of helping people in your home state is the Dollywood theme park. Well, of course it is. People want to go along and have fun. So there you are, a theme park for all the family, bringing money into a very poor area of the United States, and above all, bringing employment at all areas for people in that part that she loves so much. A central core of this work is her giant, profound belief in literacy. As Dolly said, you can never get enough books into the hands of enough children. She doesn't just say that. From 1995, she has ploughed money into the Imagination Library, sending out books first in her local state, then across America, and that has now become a worldwide programme of giving books to families and especially to children. Considering that her own father could not read or write, that's clearly a wish that she has had really from her very earliest days. It's estimated now that in her work through the Imagination Library, they have distributed over 100 million books across the world. His figures are staggering. They send out over 1 million books every month to improve literacy of all children who are attending school. And a vital aspect of that, which I'm very happy to mention, of course, is that the books are now being done on Braille, so that visually impaired and blind children can access the world of imagination, which Dolly seeks to broaden out to as many young kids as possible. Time for another Dollyism, I think. What about this one? I was the first woman to burn my bra. It took the fire department 4 days to put it out. Now, the Dolly shape, well, curvy, I think, would be an understatement. But that, in fact, led to a very strong Scottish connection that I have to mention. Because when Professor Ian Wilmot and the team at Roslin were doing experimentation on sheep, they finally managed to craft a cloned sheep. And they decided to give this world-breaking first a special name. And that became the most famous sheep in the world, Dolly the Sheep. Now, I don't think Dolly herself was at all offended by being given this title. And she knew that Dolly was a very famous and a very important sheep. But I think Professor Ian Wilmot was a bit concerned he had upset her. And he issued a statement saying, you know, it wasn't meant to be disrespectful to the lady in question or to the women of the world in general. The name really helped humanise a research project. I think it was good for us. It made us look human. And you know, in that spirit, I'm sure she appreciated having that name attached to such an important scientific project. You'd be surprised, said Dolly, how much it costs to look this cheap. This is a woman who doesn't mind people knowing that she's had her fair bit of surgery done. And of course, the wigs, how famous are the wigs? Sometimes she's asked, you know, how long does it take to do your hair? But she wisely says, well, I don't know because I'm never there. And the wigs are not only the glamour aspect of her stage appearances. I didn't know this until I was studying for my chat today. They serve a very practical purpose because when she's on stage wearing her sparkly figure-hugging outfits, her wig is where they put the microphone, which merely makes it very practical as well as very attractive. A few things just to close about Dolly, who I've really just given you an insight, a very little insight into, is the fact that she always loves food. In fact, she says, my weaknesses have always been food and men, in that order. She doesn't only proclaim her love for food, she even specifies her favourite food. Now you might think this is a multimillionaire woman who could order anything exotic, frankly, from anywhere in the world. But no, Dolly's favourite food is potatoes. Every diet, says Dolly, every diet I ever fell off has been because of a potato. I just love potatoes. Baked potatoes, mashed potatoes, or French fries. I couldn't go without them. oh, makes her feel so real and makes her seem really very wise. The ultimate accolade is from the people of her own area who revere her as a preserver of their land, as an innovator in bringing employment to the area, and now have given her a statue in Tennessee, where she's sitting a little bit like the Little Mermaid on the rock in Copenhagen Harbour. It shows her as a young barefoot singer holding her guitar and smiling. And the words they would like to give to Dolly is maybe, I hope you will agree, very well merited, the Queen of the Appalachia. And I'll just finish with her favourite recipe. We're back to food again, folks. Now, if you're inclined to try this recipe and you decide it's not for you, please don't complain about me. I'm passing on another Dollyism. My favourite food, says Dolly, is always macaroni cheese with fried apples. I must confess I haven't tried it yet. So if I'm not doing very much over the next few weeks, I'll try the Dolly special recipe. Thanks once again. Oh, and by the way, listen to the music as well, because it's fabulous. Thanks so much.
TNF Soundings.
With that TNF feature about the life of Dolly Parton outside of country music, we end this edition of the Samwell News for the first week of September. Yes, I did know about Dolly's work around reading and literacy. In fact, there was a whole BBC programme, which I might have somewhere in my archives, about her work in helping people to read. It's hard to think these days that so many people grow up without learning to read. There was no quiz this week. We simply didn't have room for it. And in any case, Pam's sister is still busy getting back from Dallas, Texas, I think, or somewhere in Texas, right up to the northwest corner of America in the state of Washington. So that's quite a journey. Thanks to our readers this week, James, Debbie, Lauren, Sargent, Pam, who took up the reading of Monday's news because Jenny was just too overwhelmed with work at the beginning of the school term, and ending up with Kate. And on Lauren, well, look out for her, because obviously she may well be appearing in a theatre somewhere near you. Who knows, she might make it onto television if she's looking to get into the acting profession. Of course, she's been reading for us for 6.5 years now, since way back at the beginning of the COVID lockdown. Thanks also, of course, to Tony and Gavin at the Town Hall doing the post-out of the pen drives and CDs, and also Sue picking the articles, and a big thank you to Linda in Raleigh getting us the two Albion match reports for this week. Very mixed bag there, but at least they did draw with Charlton. That's it then for this week. Hope you've enjoyed this edition, and we'll be back with you again next week.
To use our talk phone service to listen to Sandwell Talking News or leave us a message, phone 0121 699 6696. If you are using a landline in the 0121 area, then just dial 699 6696.